Welcome everyone, and thank you for joining the Equal Voice Action virtual discussion. I'm excited to be a part of this. Session today will focus on youth development and engagement for social change, which I think is really important with all that's going on in the world right now. I'm sure all you have to do is turn on your local news to see that social change and politics and issues that are affecting young people are front and center. And so I think this panel is right on time in that regard. And so my name is Shaka Barrows. I'm the Deputy Director with the W.W. Burns Institute, which is also home to the Community Justice Network for Youth, a national network of community organizations working to stop the bringing to jail, stop the flow of young people in the justice system. And we also work within community with justice systems across the country, and specifically by engaging communities in that regard. And so for me, this is a great opportunity to have a panel to hear from two people who I see as really experts on this notion of not just engaging young people, but also doing it with a perspective of race, ethnicity, the impact of culture, community, language, and so I'm really excited to be a part of this panel, and so I want to just introduce my panelists. We have Albino Garcia, who is the founder and executive director of La Placita, which is, you know, you'll hear more about it, but it's really a fantastic organization. If you're ever in Albuquerque and you get a chance, I recommend definitely connecting and trying to make a visit happen. There's so much to be learned from what they're doing. And my other panelist is LaShawn Amato, who is the National Coordinator for Community Action Teams for Youth Opportunity United, or Opportunity Youth United, rather, and a youth-driven movement, and really a young leader who is, I think, embodies the future of where we're trying to go and the energy that's going to be needed to get us there. And so we have some perspective from one of the older members of the panel who's been around, and we also have a young voice here who has a lot to offer and some leadership under his belt as well. And so with that being said, before we get into the panel, I want to just say a few things about housekeeping. If you have never been on a webinar before, then you and me are both the same. Now, I've been on a few webinars, and as an attendee, you will be muted. So if you want to communicate with us, there's a chat function. You can write some questions. I'll be keeping track of those questions. So please chat to chime in if you want to, you know, get a question on the table. And also, if you're just interested in taking this forward, Equal Voice Action on its website will be a place for people to connect and this conversation to continue. I also want to say I'm a board member of Equal Voice Action, which you'll also be heard referenced as EVA. And so that is a national vehicle that is really just emerging, which will be, you know, an opportunity for folks to join and be a member. Both individuals can join as well as organizations. And so by participating today, if you go on the website, you can also join EVA for free. We're trying to build it as a membership-based organization where people pay into it and we, you know, kind of build our own vehicle. However, in the beginning, there's some opportunities for folks to join for free. So if you go on there, type in EVA free, you will be able to get a free membership to Equal Voice Action. So now for today's discussion, what I thought we'd do is hear first from LaShawn, and I wanted to give him a chance to just introduce himself, talk a little bit about his experience with the youth development work, and also give some perspective on where he sees things at. So LaShawn, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, it's afternoon on the East Coast. I will just say that as a young person, I was kicked out of three high schools, and I was disconnected for about 3 years. The last high school that I was dismissed from, they sort of just pushed me out. They didn't really give me any options. They didn't say, hey, you should go ahead to get some services, to get your GED, whatever that you need. So I was left on my own to figure out this next phase of my life. At the time, it was a sweet deal because I didn't want to go to school anyway, so they just, like, sealed the deal for me. But as time continued to progress, and like I said, two years of being disconnected, I found myself perishing. I mean, I was getting locked up. You know, I couldn't get a job. My potential was going to waste, and I knew that I needed more for myself. But the question was where to find it. So I went to youth. I started looking to a few programs and applied and sort of did interviews. But when I went to Youth Build, that's where I landed, and that's where I came out successful. And I would say that the magic of that program was three things. And one was that they gave me all types of services. Youth Build is a comprehensive program, so they provide job training, education, leadership development, counseling, case management, community service. So they gave me all of that. But what I appreciate the most from that program, and what I think what resonates most with young people who come from similar backgrounds, is they gave love, trust, and respect. And I'll say love is because, quite frankly, the communities we come from, quite frankly, the world, it's a cold world. And when we're out in these streets, you know, we have to put on the show and we have to survive, right? So we always need that place where we can sort of let our guard down, you know, receive love and also be in a position to give love at the same time. So like I said, when people deal with that in the streets is one thing. Some people can go home and get that. But a lot of young people in our programs don't even have homes to go to, so they're not getting no love at all. So at the basic, bare minimum, when young people come into that program, they know that they're going to get all these services, but they know that they're going to have caring adults there to help guide them through and build the resilience and everything else that they need to be successful transitioning back into that traditional system. Secondly, respect. Part of the reason why I didn't make it in high school was because, you know, anytime you challenge a teacher, if they're not serving your needs, you know, that's misinterpreted as disrespect. You get kicked out. There's a back and forth. And quite frankly, a lot of these young people that come into the program have kids of their own. So when you relate to young people as if they're a young person, so to say, and they don't have no sense of agency or autonomy or independency, then that's sort of where things get a little tricky and they disengage. So I think that the respect aspect was definitely another one. And the last one was trust. Because they gave me love, because they gave me respect, I was able to trust them. And because I was able to trust them, I made myself vulnerable to them to guide me and push me into the path that I needed to be on. Because when I originally came into the program, I just wanted to come in, get my GED, pick up a trade really quickly. But they had better plans for me, and they saw the potential of me that I didn't see at the time. And they said, you know, LaShawn, we respect your decision, but why don't you try this route, the post-secondary education route? And I took them up on the offer. And, you know, as I mentioned, I went from being a high school dropout to just last week walking the stage, receiving my master's degree. And all of that because they saw the potential of me, and they pushed me, and they gave me the love, respect, and trust that I needed to make that happen. Now, me as a leader, I try to make sure that I pay that forward because, like I said, one thing I learned about youth food is paying it forward because there's this notion in our communities of get rich to get out the hood, and that's the reason why young people don't have role models and the vicious cycle continues to perpetuate. So I'm very intentional of making sure that I'm going back to my community, going back to my youth build program, showing these young people the love, showing them the hope, and, you know, try to serve as that role model so that they know, like, you know, they're next.
I just want to thank you, LaShawn, for starting us off. And, you know, for the viewers, LaShawn is on actually calling in because the video connection is a little off. So if you see that, you know, don't fret. We've got it under control. And again, I think the points you touched on are critical. When we, you know, doing this work at the Burns Institute, we go around the country working with justice systems all the time. And one of the things we're always looking for are those real opportunities for trusted relationships with caring adults. Like, and is anyone incentivizing this? And how much are we actually investing in this? And so I think that, you know, the points you've made in that regard are critical about love and just feeling that you have a connection, you go to a place and that you need a place where you can feel that kind of respect as well, I think is critical. And so I wanted to then turn to Albino because one of the things LaShawn also mentioned were the communities where these young folks are coming from, and how what I took from his comments, well, we need to invest in, you know, building those communities really and bringing resources, not just services and programs, right, but actual community investment, which I know is a part of the core mission of La Placita and some of the work you've done in New Mexico. So I wanted to shift to Albino for you to talk a little bit about how you've gone about doing this work, why you started your organization. Understanding we only have 60 minutes and you could probably, you know, talk about this for much longer. You know, why don't you give us some of the flavor in relation to what some of what LaShawn was talking about.
Good morning, maybe afternoon for some of you by now. Really honored to be here. And I first want to just start off with, you know, LaShawn, when you were talking about, you know, getting seen out of schools and stuff like that, you know, here my episodes were in the 60s and the 70s, man, right? A few decades before you, right? And I went to 16 schools, man. And I got kicked out of 12 schools growing up, man. Right. And I never graduated. Right. And I still have never walked the line. Right. So my hat's off to you, bro. You know, that is so, so powerful. And that's, you know, sometimes you go up and you want folks to have what and your family and your children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews and community, you know, members to have what you did it, right? And that's kind of a little bit of our story here, you know. And so that's some of the reason why we do what we do, Shaka. You know. So we're based here in Albuquerque, and you mentioned about about not just services, and that's probably, you know, our greatest strength and our greatest sustainable challenge, because and it also, you know, to a degree, you know, we have a great deficit in identity, you know, in our people. From all levels, and not just indigenous to this continent, but you know, all people in our national society, right? Because there's this great influence of you know, of identity based on this kind of subcultural values and so forth, of how we identify ourselves and so forth, and we find medicine and strength in helping people connect to their ancestral roots and identity, and going back to a sense of belonging and a sense of place and space, and a sense of family that we know works for them. If it doesn't work in a traditional sense, it'll work in a subcultural sense, gangs and, you know, street, you know, identities, and even, you know, market force identities, et cetera. And they'll create this sense of belonging. So what we try to say is, you know, identify and create here in Albuquerque is a space, you say, a space for a space-based people with no space, and a place for a place-based people with no place. So we have a center of gravity here. And people often say, you know, there's something different when they come onto our little, right into our driveway. It's this sense of like home feeling, for a lot of natives, they say this feels like the res, man. Feels like tribal land right here in the middle of Albuquerque, right? Others, you know, this feels like the barrio, the neighborhood, the family, you know. And so that's really important. We also extend that around us. You know, most people know that we're an alternative detention site here in the community. So we have kids here right now who are at various levels of custody, surveillance, or they could be locked up on the other side of Albuquerque. They could be in the detention center now. They come here, and to be very honest, a lot of them are indoctrinated. They come here first expecting an agency, not a family, right? And on Tuesday, we have a monthly meeting where people from all sectors of the community come together, kids, their families, their parents, my staff. My staff make up over 100 years of incarceration if you combine all the time sitting in a box. We're one of the only organizations that can say that here in New Mexico. So we got together, and the topic for this month's gathering was recovery from addiction through culture. And, you know, it's treatment, you know, capacities, right? You know, culture is our medicine. And, you know, again, you know, there are those that identify as Native, Chicano, African-American, whatever. But all of us have certain traits of culture that are very therapeutic and medicinal to us. And those are important in all of our activities. Again, all the senses that it provides, a sense of identity, a sense of belonging, and a sense of ownership, and a sense of space and place. So maybe we'll, I'll turn it over back to you, and if there's anything other specific you want to go into, we can.
Right on. Well, you know, I think this is a good opportunity to think about, you know, LaShawn. I mean, you grew up in your, you know, relating to some of what Albina was talking about, right? And you were a participant in the program. Now you've graduated. You're actually working in it. Talk a little bit about, you know, what it's like to go on that trajectory and how that influences your vision for where you think we need to go in the future.
I think as far as like working on the national level, like I said, sometimes I think it's important to have that sense of belonging, that sense of purpose, as Albina mentioned, because as a graduate coming into a national office, there's implicit stigma. You always feel like you have to prove yourself, you try to break beyond this lens of being you as a young leader and as a colleague. So that's one aspect of the work is, you know, coming into a space and feeling like you always have to prove yourself as a young black man. One, I'm young. Two, I'm black. And three, I'm a graduate of the program. So I got a lot going on that I felt like I had to sort of overperform and improve myself within the organization. And like I said, now, you know, I'm more qualified than probably half the building. No shade. But, you know, I've always felt the need to keep driving and going hard. And then secondly, another challenge coming from the ground to the national level is a lot of, I feel like, some people come into this work and see it as a 9-to-5. And I come in it without a clock. You know what I mean? And sometimes my passion for the work can get a little tricky in an instance, especially if I feel like folks are treating it as a 9-to-5 or, you know, just having that extra passion sometimes can just, you know, damage. Because if I do speak up, it can be controversial, and if I hold it in, it's toxic inside of me and it takes away. But I just think through, like, navigating through all those different frustrations on top of all the external frustrations out there. But that all raises the importance of what Albina would say, like really being clear on who you are, being confident in who you are, and also having that self-care, you know, and being able to, like, get all that toxic waste out of your body, because unfortunately in our community, we are taught to hold it in, and that's feeding into why these young people, some of these young people are angry and they're acting out the way that they are. So, you know, we have to let young people know that, one, it's okay to let it out, and two, give them the space to do it constructively. So I think that's all I have to say for that. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, man, and I want to ask a follow-up on that, because, you know, I used to always explain to people, like, it's hard to imagine and remember what it's like to go living when you don't know where your next meal's coming from. To then go to an organization where everybody's paid, and right, or to make these shifts in life, right? And oftentimes when I see, you know, the program, the young people in the program and the people working in there, there's even a disconnect there around just basic transportation and getting around. And so, you know, I was curious about some of the, you know, just some of the not, you know, the non-traditional aspects of this, right? Just the regular life. I mean, you may still have friends who are still, you know, involved in the street life, right? But yet you're at work and you have to balance those two worlds. And so that, you know, I just wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about that too. And that, because this, to me, this is where the future of all of the work we're doing is headed, right? Is finding people like you and seeing the need to lift you up so that there's more albinos in the future, right? We have more people who built institutions who understand these dynamics that are real to the communities that really are in need of some real support and investment. So I'm just, you know, one of the things I know in terms of young people transitioning from the, you know, being in the streets to then working in these programs and trying to go on, are kind of navigating some of those interpersonal challenges. Professionalism doesn't always create enough space for people to talk about. So just thought we could get into some of that as well.
I'll quickly speak on it. It's definitely real, and it also speaks to this larger notion of how young people are sold this false story of just the opportunity youth of once you're done with the program, or once you sort of cross this line that, you know, you've made it, life's just going to be a walk in the park. And the reality is, I think life got even more stressful, more controversial, more things just got real hectic after I actually started trying to be positive. And it's like trying to remain positive in an environment that is, again, toxic. I mean, even in my home, I don't have the support that I need to handle the level of work that I have to handle as far as school and work. I mean, it's to the point where some of my cousins were, like, laughing at me, like, oh, my God, you're doing. They were questioning, like, you must like going to school. Why do you go to school so much? Like, one, that just frustrates me. And then, two, like I said, just watching as you sort of progress out and sort of become successful, and as you watch your peers sort of remain stuck, to some extent you feel guilty, and to some extent you want to help, and to some extent they're not there with you, and you get frustrated that they can't take the same path that you took. But the reality is that there's no one path, and everyone's light bulb is going to go off at a different time. But like I said, it's all about just showing them, because I would always go back to my community. Like I said, you guys should go to college. You guys should do this. You guys should do that. And all I was doing was really just telling them, and then I was going blue in the face, and then I said, all right, this is enough. But like I said, these young people don't have role models. So I was like, okay, so now I got to show them. But once they see me taking all these trips, once they see all the benefits coming in, they see me with the president, with Obama, and all these important people, now they're like, oh, how can I be down? It's because they see what it looks like. So like I said, that all goes back to just like making sure that I go back and be that role model, because it's frustrating. Every day I go back to my community and I see the liquor store open before the grocery store is open. And it's just insane.
I appreciate that response. And Albino, I can feel your energy. I'm like, I feel like maybe you have any reflection or response to what LaShawn just talked about. I know you've lived through much of this yourself and have a lot to offer, but thought we'd just have a real conversation, you know. So you have any reflection or reaction to that?
I'm still doing this little technology thing and getting on and off of mute, so excuse me about that. I'm listening to you, Sean, and I'm going, you know, I hear you, and the thing that stuck out for me right now was so recently we became, you know, those of you who may or may not know, you know, the JDAI movement, I'm sure, you know, a lot of you, you know, come from that background, otherwise you wouldn't be on this, you know, webinar. And all the work Burns does, and Shaka has been in my community for a long time, working back and forth. You know, JB, all the rest of the crew, Rakesh, Gina, everybody, man. And, you know, Albuquerque, Bernalillo County had been like a model site for alternative detention initiative. And when I came on board, because of these good folks, very intentionally and requested by them, I had really very little interface with the criminal justice system other than, with, say, holding the hand of a mother or a grandma in court while their kids were getting sentenced, right? And there as an advocate for them when their knees would get kind of shaky and they want to faint, you know, kind of hold them up and they start crying. And so until I got in, you know, I was invited by you, Shaka, and JB, and everybody to come to the table. Most of my local stakeholders, criminal justice stakeholders, had, you know, had very little knowledge or understanding of how to communicate or collaborate with the community. And so when we initiated that, you know, stuff hit the fan, and it got you know, it got ooey and gooey for a minute, right? And now today, as a result, the Alternative Detention Program is based out of my organization here in the South Valley of Albuquerque, the zip code that still holds the highest rate of incarcerated and adjudicated kids, and the zip code that has the highest rate of dedicated JPO, juvenile probation officers, etc. So it's a big investment, you know, still on the criminal justice side, both positive and negative, to be very frank. So having said that, now, very recently in January of 2017, we became the Bernalillo County alternative detention site. So we got those kids here now. And so now having them here, we're able to provide an approach and resources, and yet a lot of the families are still unlearning what, you know, what they've learned about how to interface with alternatives to detention initiatives, because it's always initially been controlled, you know, and led by representatives of the criminal justice system, not the community. So as a result, there's a reaction when the youth and the family start to interface with us. So we're going through a transitional phase here, right? And not just us, but the families and the youth. So it, in some ways, some sense, you know, kids expect one thing. They expect, oh, well, this is, they treat us like agency folk, and they go into the yes sir, no sir stuff, but they don't really care. They don't, that's just a guard, a shield, right? They say, wait a minute, man, you know, don't treat me like the man. That's not here. You know, you treat us like relations here, like people, you know. And so trying to, you know, remove that behavioral indoctrination, right? That's very critical.
Yeah.
And what we found out very quickly, based on what LaShawn said, that really clicked for me was, so you know the alternative detention program is like a, it's like a 30-day program. If they do good for those 30 days, then they'll either get a reduced sentence or alternative recommendation and this and that, whatever, whatever. And they get to do their time outside versus incarcerated. Cool. But 30 days, we realized real fast, they flourished. They did great. They started to believe in themselves barely. But 30 days is a 50-yard dash. We always, we joke about, you know, we play with words and sayings here, right? So you've heard that, you know, 50-yard dash, and then there's a long-distance run. Well, behavioral change and conditioning and indoctrination, right, and assimilation, you know, you don't change that overnight in 30 days, right? It takes, it's a long-distance run. So right now, we're already, we submitted several proposals to national organizations and philanthropic organizations, institutions that know of us and so forth, because I realized real quick, we need post-program programming, because, you know, we got a position, you know, to take care of them for those 30 days, but the real work happens when they're not mandated to come. And so how do you sustain that, you know, and that's where the real test of, you know, what you're trying to teach and support and help happens, to see if, you know, kids is going to stick it out, even if you don't have to be here, right? So that what, you know, challenges us, to see if we can, you know, convince them, use that 30 days just to get them to really commit to them, to themselves, to get those families to believe in their kids again, and for those kids to believe in themselves enough to want to continue the program without the strong arm, so to speak.
And Albino, you also talked about having your staff, I believe you said about over 100 years of incarceration experience. How can you talk about how you're able to recruit those folks onto your team and to keep them on your team, and what kind of programming having them on your team, you know, how has that led to unique programming over there at La Poti?
So if I let the cat out the bag, you know, you might have to pay for that, bruh. No, I'm kidding. So check it out, man. It was serendipitous, to be very honest, and it was just, it was a straight up hustle. All right. So I had bros coming out of prison, you know, male and female, you know, who would come out of prison. And when you're doing youth work, a lot of bros, when they're locked up, they get out, they're so happy. They want to change. You know, their whole world is like open again. And they're like, yo, they come through my doors and like, hey, man, I want to do this work, man. I want to give back, man. I got a story to tell, you know, this and this and that. And I said, well, just because you did a nickel or a dime, don't make you an outreach worker, bro. Right? You have to, you know, show that you know, you ain't just clean or not a nonviolent or non-criminal while you're locked up. You got to show that while you're out. So you got to earn your way here to a degree. Now, then when life hits, once you get released, like bills start to, and you got to find a place to live, then you got the flu and you need to go to a doctor. Then, you know, you got to try to get a phone and, you know, you don't have no transportation and all this shit hits. That's when the real hustle kicks in. So I'm going to be honest with you, man. This is how we do it. And all you listening to this, you know, you can send me a percentage of the money you're going to save when you hear this, okay? All right, here it goes. Look, man, we have a community college and a university here. And every community college and a university in New Mexico has what we call AmeriCorps or Service Corps. Everybody's heard of that. They also have financial aid. You know, FAFSA, they have work study. Now, Very honestly, the work study office here and the service learning office, those are my champions, because they came to me and said, look, we got students that are coming back to college who are ex-felons, and none of our after-school programming or work-study sites will accept them because of their previous convictions. Now, Bino, you work with that population. Could you use some free, you know, human resources? Hell yeah. So guess what? I have literally saved, I would guess to say over $1 million or maybe going on $2 million in the past 10 years of salary costs, because I hire previously convicted work study. They get paid 20 hours a week to work here at La Placita, go to school. I incubate them, I support them, I mentor them. I'm hard on them. Sometimes they don't make it. I have to let them go because they we have protocols here, right? But you know, and for every 10 that come through that want to say they want to really do this kind of work, one out of the 10 will really truly stick it out. It's a long distance runner. Others are just coming, look, see what they can get out of it, right? It's like a temporary thing for them, and some of them, and that's okay too. But the bottom line is, that's how I've been doing it here. We're an AmeriCorps site. We're a Food Corps national site. I got two positions that are Food Corps. I got two positions that are Public Ally site. You know, Michelle Obama's program. I got AmeriCorps Vistas. And I got MetroCorps. You know, the folks that have to, you know, pay off their citations by doing community service, I'm one of those too. So everything we got going on in this neighborhood, you know, and it's a medicinal factor. Look, this is what happened to me. Youth work, giving back, and so forth is something that a recovering cat needs, right? Somebody recovering from violence and addiction and criminal background, etc. We have to have a purpose, a mission. And that becomes very therapeutic to give back. But how do you sustain it? Well, it's a lot easier said than done, but it can be done. And now I got a whole little army of cats, right, that are long distance runners, man. And they keep coming and they keep incubating. We are a non-traditional leadership institute. I ain't kidding. And man, our bros are walking the line now, man. Right out of prison, coming over here, working in the community for a couple of years, getting their degrees, and they're walking the line. Jeez, they're even superseding my academic, journeys, man. And I'm a part of that. So anyway, that's my little piece.
Oh man, no, thank you for sharing that. And LaShawn, you know, just similarly, how does that, you know, you have any reflections listening to Albino? Does it bring anything up for you?
Nah, I mean, it was all so powerful. And it just makes me think of my experience trying to get my foot into the professional world and the barriers that I face having at Corey. And despite working full time, going to school full time, I had to volunteer at a nonprofit to get the experience that I needed to enter that sector. And the reality is, there's not too many people that are willing, even if you're volunteering, but a lot of AmeriCorps positions, I don't want to say discriminate against, but they sort of filter out individuals who have court-involved backgrounds. So it's hard to find someone that will, one, let you get your foot in the door to gain some meaningful, purposeful experience. And I think one thing that he said that was super powerful was, like, someone who comes from this background, like, that's part of our medicine is giving back to our community. But we give so much of ourselves that sometimes we deplete ourselves, and sometimes we get so worn thin that you feel like you don't have much to offer your community. You perceive yourself to not have much to offer. So that just raises a larger issue of, like I said, the self-care and making sure that myself as a young leader, making sure that I'm getting the development that I need, because that's part of the challenge with my work with the National Youth Alliance right now, is that we've been hustling, we've been trying to get money on the ground, to make sure that young leaders on the ground are getting what they need. But we also have to find that fine balance of, like, we're giving our all to these communities, but what are we getting back in return? We need a little bit. We can give this much, but we want, you know, at least this much to help us build our strength. Because the better we are, the better we can work with our communities and work with our people. So now we're talking about, you know, creating fellowships and all these different things. But one, it's important to have those champions and those golden pockets that will take on these individuals and give them the opportunity to prove to society that they can, one, have a purpose, two, have good work ethic. And then once they have that resume, because once I got that experience and once I got that sort of resume built, I was able to apply and land in the youth field. So I think those are the two strongest things that I heard from that. And I just want to really just, I don't have a hat to take off, but I just really respect the work that you guys are doing up there. It's deep.
Yeah. And this is where we are right now in this country, right? I mean, the things Albino discussed are still seen as non-traditional and as kind of these radical notions of how we can provide services. And, you know, your experience, LaShawn, in terms of just trying to break into this whole field and the hurdles and the barriers to that that you even mentioned and the many others that you didn't mention, right? And I think both of you probably can attest to the struggles that are involved in that. And for me, that's really what's ahead is, you know, there's an industry, there's a bunch of people who get paid really well to work to reform, to try to tweak and change these systems that have essentially not served the communities in a way that is, you know, healthy and holistic and empowering, but rather have been a part of, you know, the demise of many of these communities in terms of, if there's an investment, it's an investment in surveillance, incarceration, and apparatus of justice, when there's opportunity for, you know, investing in jobs, better housing. People aren't seeing that unless it's time to switch that neighborhood over, and we call that gentrification, which many people are seeing as a slap to the face, because for years this community didn't have opportunities and didn't have resources. But now that it's seen as desirable from, you know, folks who have more money and who don't look like the people who live there, then boom, we can start fixing streetlights, we can repave the roads, we can make parks look brand new again. There's all these things that are happening, right, that are about investment in this grander sense of it, right? Because I think we started off at the individual level, and then through this conversation, we've talked a little bit about the organizational level. And now, where my head always goes to is community, large. We know that, you know, simply coming up with tools, technologies that reform these systems is not going to change the overall dynamic of historical institutional racism, segregation, all the things that lead people into situations where, you know, systems have to respond to their neighbor, right? Instead of us seeing that as an opportunity to invest, which I believe is fundamental, right, is community investment and trying to change dynamics in the neighborhoods, not change the neighborhood so somebody else can live there, but why don't we, like a farm, you know, farm up and build up these communities? What would it take to do that? And so I'd like to pivot right now and see, you know, I think we have a question or two coming from the text, so I'll pay attention to that. But if you have questions, throw them out there. But I wanted to open it up to either of you to just react to, you know, this dynamic, right? I mean, we want to have good services, good programs. We want to have those kind of supports. But if the communities are still not having the investment, are we not fighting this uphill battle? And so, you know, talk to me a little bit about how that lands on you.
You're on mute, Albino. I'll go after him.
One of you guys, Taz, got to answer my question now, or the people will just be sitting listening.
Okay, I'm sorry, man. trouble with this thing, man. I'm so sorry. Break it down, man. What was it again? What was the question?
Just really thinking about, you know, we've started talking about individual, right, transformation, and what it means to have a good program and a good organization to work with. But if we're still living in communities that don't have the necessary investments, real opportunities, are just these reforms and these programs enough, or what do you think about the larger issue in terms of community investment and really building neighborhoods where folks are coming from right now, who are coming into these systems, justice systems, and things like that?
You know, that's another webinar, bro. But I'm gonna do the best I can in a minute here. So my take is, not popular even amongst my own peers, bro. Cause I'm talking about, you know, today when I talk to activists and community workers and street workers, you know, I challenge them to get beyond what's easy. Working with high-risk kids and children and offenders and families and community, for me, that's gravy, man. I love that stuff. That's easy. That comes to me. That's what I am, right? All that. The real work is no longer with my own people. The real work is with the system. You know, and what that requires is for me to transcend my own biases, my own assumptions, my own trauma from the system. And if I'm going to be as authentic in working with the system as a community member, as I am with my own members of the community, then I must treat them truly as my community. And these are very, you know, people who represent at times great harm and trauma to my people and to me. So I have to take a real deep look at myself and say to myself, if I'm going to influence something on a systematic level, on an institutional level, right, then am I going to be authentic, or am I going to be operating out of anger and shame and trauma and pain and rage, right? Or am I going to transcend my own and treat them, even though they don't reciprocate to a certain degree my behavior? I got to get beyond that and really be authentic and congruent to my soul, to my spirit, to my culture, to my traditional ways, and work one individual, one division, one department, you know, one probation officer, one DA, one judge at a time, etc., right? You know, I haven't gone to the politicians yet. That's a real tough one for me, but I'll work on that later, right? But, you get my point.
I got you. I'll jump in really quickly. It makes me think of a comment that one of the young leaders from Boston, they work with one of our community action teams. Her name is Amanda Shabowich. And we were at a conference, I just left there at Aspen, and she said that whether we're talking about young people or just communities in general, she said decisions made at tables without young people will be flawed, incomplete, and not sustainable. So even if you pour a whole bunch of programs into the community and you find out the community's not invested in them, it's because who's to say that that's what they want, right? So too often these programs, policies, and practices are designed for opportunity youth or for low income youth from people who are so far removed from the community, it's not even funny. So that's where the work is now, is just trying to make sure that young people, people who come from our communities are in those leadership roles and decision-making roles in politics and philanthropy and, you know, in the private sector, just everywhere, because until we emerge in those spaces, we're going to continue to be begging or educating or informing, whatever you want to call it. So the work right now is just really putting our people in those positions so that they're making those decisions for those programs, for those policies, for those practices that are coming to that community, so that when they do come, that young people are just seizing them and, you know, getting what they need. Because, for instance, I'll tell you, for example, I'm trying to do some work in my country in Cape Verde, and, what you know, I was talking to them about doing a program. They were telling me that the young people there said that they were fatigued because, one, they had all these programs coming. One, they didn't know about it, and two, the young people didn't like the program. They were like, okay, it's very dedicated, but we don't like this service. So, you know, my goal going into country is to make sure that if I go and I want to set something up, the first group of people that I'm going to talk to, before I talk to the prime minister, before I talk to the UN, before I talk to the people with the money, what do the young people want? Because at the end of the day, they're the most important stakeholder. I'll stop there.
Right on. Well, we got a couple of questions. We only have about 9 minutes left in this webinar, and I wanted to just throw up. There was two questions, both about one, recruiting and finding professionals in the community who want to work with young people and help cultivate, you know, skills and teach skills. And then the other is just also about how you find volunteers and keep them going over long periods of time, because I think folks have run into some turnover. Do you all have any reflections on either of those two questions?
I'll just say quickly, passion over credentials, because a lot of qualified, passionate individuals in the community are not in these positions because they're being filtered out because they don't have a master's degree or a bachelor's degree or whatever it may be. And we all know college completion rates in our community, so they're getting left out from these positions. Even in nonprofit, one study shows that there's a lack of minority leaders in the nonprofit sector as well as the other sectors. They're out there, they're willing to work, but this again goes back to policy and practice. What is it in your organization that's preventing them to be able to see those opportunities? Because they're there, and a lot of people in the community want to give back, and they know what it takes. The people in the community know them, respect them, and I'll just stop there.
So we have a little saying here. You've heard it, Shaka. We call ourselves BTDTs, been there, done that, right? And so we have a lot of our credentials, you know, really, you know, our the life we've lived, etc., and the change that we're, that we're trying to live in ourselves as well as, you know, and in others, right? What we expect and hope to change in others, right? So there's that level. Sustaining it's actually a lot easier to sustain somebody who is not educated in the formal justice formal system versus those who are educated in the criminal justice system. Like you said, passion, dedication. They're from here and they ain't going anywhere. You know, this their investment is back in their own people, their own community, you know. So coming from, you know, volunteers that come from your own people, that's always the best, very frankly. But then we have, you know, like right now, we get a lot of folks that contact us through Facebook, a lot of folks that contact us on our website, some of our YouTube postings, etc., and want to volunteer. We had a whole bunch of different university classes and coursework here at UNM, and they want to send down their students, right, to do little research papers and volunteer this and this.